honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance to say happy 100th birthday this weekend to Bill Pratt of Fresno, California. He and his older brother Basil both survived the attack on Pearl Harbor aboard the battleship USS Nevada. And after the attack, Bill, it sounds like you were just kind of in limbo there, waiting for your next assignment.
If we had ships coming in from the States that needed extra men, more crew, and we had some ships that weren't damaged that bad that had men killed, but anyhow, we were just a pool of men that they drawed on if they needed them there. If a ship come in and needed so many men, well, let's get them. As soon as a position opened on a battleship, I got it. They tried to keep men on the same type of ship that they served on. They wouldn't go in cold turkey and not know what they were doing. If you're all on a battleship, they put you on a battleship. The procedure's all the same, so you know what to do.
There's something else I'm curious about, too, because, again, I didn't live through this. Most of the people listening to this didn't live through Pearl Harbor, but they've heard the stories, right? Maybe they've heard the song Remember Pearl Harbor, or they've seen pictures of the tattered flag. They've heard Roosevelt's speech the next day that told the whole country and the whole world about it. So they've gotten a sense of what the impact of that day was and what sprang up around the country in response to it. But I'm wondering about for you, for guys like you and your brother and your shipmates, what kind of emotions were you feeling after that?
You know, it looks hopeless for a while. If you're in the thick of it, it just seems helpless. You seem helpless for a while, but things begin to go your way, and you gather your courage and accept it and just go on. But when things look hopeless, you're hopeless. You don't expect to live through it. But if there's something that'll brighten your hopes, you latch on to it right away.
And what did that for you?
Well, the lights went out during the rain, and the bombs were hitting, and the ship was shaking and listening to one side, and then all at once your lights went out. Your lights go out. Well, if you're with other men, it's not too bad, but if you're alone, it's kind of scary. Your hopes sink right away, but the longer you survive, the more you hope. Sometimes you realize it's not as bad as what you think.
Let me ask you this. So, we just had the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and there are fewer and fewer of you guys still with us who were there that day. But all the ones that I know and have known, they emphasize the importance of remembering Pearl Harbor and keeping America alert. Is that something that's still meaningful to you? Do you think that we need to remember Pearl Harbor? And if so, why?
Well, certainly. I think you should remember those things. It's how you learn to prepare and to deal with similar incidents. The more you know about it, the better off you are. There is certain things you can do. There's certain things you shouldn't do to keep yourself safe. And you learn that.
And I understand you haven't been back to Pearl Harbor since World War II, is that right?
That's right. Well, I've had chances, but it wasn't expedient for me to go with my life here. I could drop everything and go. So I haven't been back, but I've seen pictures of it.
Well, the reason I ask is because there's probably a lot of people listening to this right now who have been there, and they've been to the USS Arizona Memorial, and on a wall of white marble, it lists 1,177 names from the Arizona, and 429 from the Oklahoma, and 60 from your ship, and over 2,400 total. So, that could have been you, could have been your brother. But when it comes to how we should remember those 2,403 Americans who died December 7th on Oahu, what do you think? How should we remember those people all these years later?
Well, I think they should be remembered. It's something that you might have to go through again. I think it better prepares people to pay attention to these things because it might happen again and prepare for it. It helps us to prepare, really.
I realize we spent a long time talking about the very first day of the war, but you were in for the rest of the war, and I'm sure there's a lot of stories there that you could share, but I'm curious about this too. Did anybody ever tell you never to volunteer for anything in the military?
Oh, that might have floated around, but generally, no.
You know why I'm asking, right? Because you volunteered for submarines, maybe the most dangerous duty of all.
Well, I didn't think much about it. I thought it might be a change of duty, something that I'd be good at. And I'd get to go to submarine school for 6 weeks. I'd be out of the war for 6 weeks. And so I took it.
I've talked to a lot of guys who went to that submarine school, New London, Connecticut. Is that right?
Yeah. They taught you about the submarine, how to operate it, what to do in case of an emergency. They teach you what the best thing to do and what they've learned, or you learn.
You know, we've been talking about Pearl Harbor. That's another place you can go now. There's a few of them around the country. San Francisco has one, the Pampanito. But at Pearl Harbor, they have a World War II submarine, the Bowfin. And I think a lot of people are surprised when they realize how different submarine technology was in World War II compared to now. For instance, you guys had to surface every night, right?
Yes. Every night we had to charge our batteries. We had to surface. But that's the best time.
And you ended up on the Tuna, is that right?
Yes.
And what were your duties aboard that sub?
Well, I stood watch like everybody else. I had the gear manifold. Now, I was a motor machine mate, and I was in the division that handled the auxiliary machinery. The air manifold, we had the high-pressure manifold and the low-pressure manifold and the water manifold, all them things that pertain to that part of the function of the ship, we run. We didn't know how, we learned.
7 battle stars in World War II, so you guys must have made quite a few patrols. Do you have some memories of some situations that got a little hairier than you wanted them to?
It seems like they were all, you felt a certain amount of dread going into the battle, because on the submarine, you can't just wait for a ship to come along and shoot it, or shoot torpedoes at it. You have to position yourself in the right position. So when you fire a spread of torpedoes, maybe 3, as you slightly turn, you let those torpedoes go in case one, well, you fire 3 because if one misses, maybe the other one hits. Oh, we sunk a ship and took a prisoner, and he was in the water, and we took 2, but one died, the other one lived. But we brought one back to Naval Intelligence. We didn't treat the prisoners mean. We, after a few days, they learned to like the men pretty well. The food was better. They got to smoke American cigarettes and all that. So they were living high on the hog. They enjoyed it because we never treated them mean. We treated them more like one of the crew than anything. But we never was mean to prisoners.
That might have been this other thing that just popped up here. It says, May 4th, 1944, the Tuna sighted a 100-ton trawler bound for Wake Island with classified documents on board, the Takima Maru. And then it put up a fight when taken under fire by the submarine's 20-millimeter guns. In the face of the returned fire, Tuna opened up with her 3-inch deck gun and scored a hit, holding Takima Maru near the stern. And 10 minutes later, it sank, littering the water with secret papers and the surviving Japanese, and that's where you guys got the prisoners.
My battle station for surface was the forward 20-millimeter gun. I remember one of their boats, it was a sub chaser or something, somebody else had damaged it, and the stern was down, and the bow was way up in the air. And the air pockets in the bow was keeping it from sinking. I was on the forward 20-millimeter gun, and I was ordered to open fire on it. They seen movement on the bow, and they ordered me to open fire, so I just riddled the bow with 20-millimeter gunfire, and it let the air out of the bow, and it just sank. And we didn't get anything off of it.
One thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that nobody else could tell us. Here's one more question for you. Because, you know, you're hitting the century mark here. That's a long time. That's a lot of years. When you look back over 100 years, is there something that you think, that you say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I appreciated the support that the people at home gave us, I think, more than anything. And I know my mother and father did. I appreciated that. And that's enough to keep you going, just to know that somebody is dependent upon you and you do your best.
So you were there the day the war began. You saw firsthand the devastation. When you finally heard the war was over, when Japan surrendered, was that significant for you?
Yes, it was, but we were expecting that to happen, but it was a great... I was in Australia, and they celebrated in the streets for over a week, and I went along with them. I was happy, too. I was glad it was over. I was eager to get on with life. I'm thankful that I survived it. I'm thankful for my wife. I'm thankful for my life, and I thank the Lord for it.
Bill mentioned his wife, Pauline, and we're going to give her the final word today. She has a pretty powerful story related to her by Bill's mother.
Bill's mother, they moved back to Kentucky, and Pearl Harbor got bombed. Here come her sister, some Bertha. Bill and Basil are gone. They're dead. They got their ship got bombed and they're gone. She said, "Bernie, you go right back home." She said, "There never was a bunch of children that honored their parents any more than my boys." And she said, "I don't believe in when I'm harmed." And that's the way it was. Because she trusted in God.
It ended up all four of her boys were in that war. It sounds like you got to talk to her about this a little bit. She spent a lot of time praying?
Yes, she did spend a lot of time praying. And she dearly loved all of her family, and they were good children, and they honored their parents. And the Bible said, if you honor your parents, you live long upon the earth. And that was her hope and prayer.
You're a mother and a grandmother and a great-grandmother. Have you ever tried to imagine yourself in her shoes in those years?
Oh, yes. It would be awful. But what you do is trust in God. I would be doing the same thing.
Is there anything you want to tell me about this guy and why you're so excited to celebrate 100 years of his life?
I'm excited to celebrate 68 years with him May 1st. He's a very good man, a sweet man. I treasure him.
There are some people listening. They're saying, hey, 68 years of marriage. They must know something I'd like to know. Is there any advice you'd have for people or maybe a secret to the longevity of your marriage?
We spend our life a lot in church. And you don't let the sun go down your anger and take care of each other. I think he's wonderful at 100 years old. The same sweet, romantic man I met 67 or 68 years ago. And we sit here and hold hands and we watch Hallmark movies. And I enjoy him very much. We enjoy each other.
You got to tell me what he did to get you to marry him 6 weeks after you met. Is that the truth?
Well, when I met this man, he knew of me for about a year. Somebody wanted me to meet him. Well, I just never went to meet him. I called this other party, and Bill was there. And he says, "I bet I know who you are." And I said, "But you don't." He says, "If I tell you who you are, will you say?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You're Pauline. I'm looking at your picture now." So he said, "What are you going to do? What are you doing this evening?" I said, "I'm going to go see a movie." He said, "Can I go with you?" And I thought he was kidding. I said, "Sure. Where are you at?" 20 minutes, he said, "I'll be there." And he went, and that was it. I mean, that evening, we seen each other every evening for 6 weeks, and we got married. Bill was a confirmed bachelor at 31 or 32 years old. I was almost 22, and he kept thinking that he was might be too old for me when he acted like he worried me, told me that I was the only woman he ever seen he wanted to marry. Well, that should have done it right there.
I guess it did.
It did, and I want to keep him. The Lord is so good and keeps him with me every day.
I don't know about you, but this is one of those that really touched my heart. Thanks to Bill and Pauline Pratt for sharing so much of their story with us. And big thanks to Glenna Morgan for letting me know about the Pratts. Please join her and join me in wishing Bill the happiest 100th birthday possible. And join us again next time here on Hometown Heroes when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.